Second speaker this morning is John Wellner from Seattle, who's going to provide us with some alternative proofs relating to persistence.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for the invitation. I do have all my talk on transparency as your slides, but I'm going to do quite a few proofs, or at least emphasize the proofs. Might go better if I use them. So I will post these on my website. Let me try to do it all the way. So this talk is rehashing a paper, 2004 paper by Brintoff and Weinstein. And in my first reading of that, I was intrigued by it because they use an inequality.
Oh. Sure. Is it on?
Yep.
Is that better? Okay. I was intrigued by their paper because they use an inequality due to Nemirovsky that I was unfamiliar with. And so Nemirovsky's inequality seemed new and curious and something that I was not aware of. And so I wanted to see if I could do it using tools I was familiar with. And I succeeded in doing that, as you'll see. It's pretty trivial. It's not hard to use empirical process methods. But then as I went on, I became more intrigued with Nemirovsky's inequality and the comparison with our empirical process tools. So I'm going to look at Nemirovsky's inequality as well and try to tell you about it, and also prove one of the theorems of Greenstein and Rittov. So this is related to yesterday's talk by Immanuel Kandas on prediction, and so in a sense it's the Greenstein-Rittov paper is considering not only an easy case in the sense of Immanuel's talk, we're focusing on prediction, but we're also focusing on the random covariate case, or random design. So it's easy in two senses, and so the proofs are actually pretty simple, and so you can actually talk about them. And so I'd like to talk about the proofs, just do the proofs. So first of all, the context. The setting is simply data so we're in this classical setting of trying to predict a response y based on covariates x1 through xp, and here p is to be thought of as large. And so I'm thinking in particular the p will be p sub n is n to the alpha for some alpha positive. Okay, so that's the setting. So we want to predict predict y. So the predictors are all going to be of the form y hat, and they're classical old linear predictors in the covariates. We're going to consider predictors that look like that. But then the beta is going to be constrained to lie in some set, B sub n, which is a subset of RP. And from the point of view of things that have gone on before in this conference, the natural sets here, and the ones considered by Greenstein and Rittov, are BNK, being the set of betas in RP, with, the L0 norm or the number of non-zero things being some number k. So that's bnk. Or sets that look like bnp. And these are betas in RP, such that the L1 norm. L1 norm is bounded by B. So this should be a B. And we're going to let both K and B depend upon N, of course. And so K will be K sub N going to infinity. P will be P sub N going to infinity. And so the thing we're interested in is prediction error for a new observation. So LP of beta is simply expectation under P of y minus the y hat, or sum beta j xj squared good old prediction error. Okay. So what do Greenstein and Ritov do? Well, first of all, so laws, law of Z will be called Pn. That can change with N. So this is on RP plus 1. And sets Bn, defining predictors that are allowed, they define beta sub n star, the optimal if you knew P, so this is beta sub n star Pn. This is the arg min, the minimum minimizer over beta in Bn of Lpn beta, the prediction error. So that's the deterministic sequence that tells us how well we could do if we optimized prediction error over betas in that region in Rp when Pn was true. Okay, so that's sort of the ideal. Or the point that achieves the ideal risk for those sets. And then they define the notion of persistence. So here's the definition. Given sets B sub n and procedures, some estimators, beta sub n, say beta sub n is persistent. Beta sub n is persistent. And this is really relative to B sub n and some collection of laws, so some families of distributions. If for every P sub n in these collections, it follows that our predictors based on something, these predictors, these guys, under Pn track the optimal. Okay, so that we want this to go in probability to zero. Okay, so that's persistence. And there's no sense of a true model. You're just tracking what you can do for these given sets, right? Okay. So it's a fairly weak notion, but it's a practical notion in the sense of being able to say, well, if you have some sets of predictors you think you can handle, then, well, persistent procedure will at least track the prediction error. Okay. So that's the setting, that's the introduction. This is my reformulation, slight reformulation of their theorem 3. So here's the theorem. If P sub n is n to the alpha, and an envelope condition f of zi, which is the maximum over all pairs j and k between 0 and p of x, I, j, x, ki minus the expected value under pn of that stuff. Well, everything's iid, so the I really doesn't matter. And here x0 so x0i is just y. So and that whole thing, just for notation. So suppose that satisfies expected value under Pn of f squared z1 is m, is finite, for all n. Well, then the conclusion is then for B sub n being little o of n over log of n to the 1/4, beta n hat given by, well, these are essentially a version of Lasso in the constrained rather than the penalized form. So this is argmin over betas in B n B sub n L empirical measure beta. Well, these are persistent. Relative to B sub n, B sub n. Persistence. So that's the elementary, easy result. This is not a hard result. This is one of the easiest results in this whole theory. And there are no conditions, almost. there's no conditions on invertibility of matrices.
Well, but that's because you're doing prediction.
I'm doing prediction, and I've got random design. Those two things. So Emmanuel was needing some condition on his non-random design matrices to get a theorem about prediction yesterday. In this setting with random design, there's no condition yet for persistence. Okay, so that's the statement of the theorem. They go on to say other things about procedures based on these model selection sets. And for the model selection sets, they start needing additional hypotheses. And in particular, right there, to get things to work nicely, to get persistent procedures for these type sets, they need boundedness of the smallest eigenvalue from below of the covariance matrix of the X's, the population covariance. And so to get things to work for these procedures, procedures based on those model selection sets, they do other things. And they start needing more about the behavior of the covariance. I think I'm not going to talk about that at all. I'm just going to prove the one easy theorem and focus on Nemirovsky's inequality. So, maybe I'll get time to come back to that. We'll see. The proof of this theorem, as I say, is quite easy. First of all, it's obviously true. Now, so in this theorem, there's another feature that's coming in that works very easily and nicely, and that is that the sets that we're persistent relative to are also used to define the procedure. So there's a direct connection between this set with which we're persistent with respect to, and the definition of the procedure. That need not be the case, and so you can have persistent procedures relative to a given set that are not connected in that way. And that's in fact the case for the model selection sets. Well, here it's very easy and nice. A couple of elementary inequalities at first. Clearly, because that's the minimizer, when that's the truth, we put in another point and we're bigger. On the other hand, if I put in beta n hat, here, because this is the minimizer, I'm less than or equal to zero. And so it's easily true that that's non-negative. And if I just do a little bit of adding, subtracting here, rearranging, I come to something that's very simple and nice. So this is L of Pn beta n hat minus L. Add in the empirical one, beta n hat. Add the empirical one back in. Subtract it out, add it in. Subtract out L Pn beta n star. And so add back in LPN beta n star, and I'm still exactly equal. All I've done is add and subtract terms. And so here I've got a comparison of population to empirical at the same point. And so I've got another comparison of empirical to population at the same point. And so what's going on with the other term? Here I've got empirical at this point. Oh, that's less than or equal to zero. So this is less than or equal to twice the sup over betas in the set bn lpn beta minus l empirical minus population comparison soup. So that's good. That's where I like to be. So what do I do next? Well, here it's just recognizing what the quadratic, what's going on here in this comparison, rewriting it just slightly. So if you let gamma be minus 1 and beta, then so this is vector and RP plus 1. So then these functions that we're dealing with here, LP n say of beta is just when I compute, well, it's gamma prime sigma covariance matrix corresponding to Pn gamma. And so we can think about this as gamma prime matrix sigma ij gamma. And of course, let's see, what's happening? Well, similarly on the empirical side, this is simply gamma prime sigma for the empirical measure, gamma. And we're just comparing those two in this expression. So things are easy. Life is not hard. Thus, LPN beta minus L population beta is simply gamma prime sigma Pn minus sigma population gamma. And this is bounded by very elementary inequality, which is simply sigma Pn minus sigma in the population, supernorm over all coordinates, and then the norm of gamma L1 squared. So that's all easy. No problem. So this means, putting these two things together, that inequality up there and this inequality, it means to show persistence. I'm down to showing LPN beta n hat minus LPN beta n star bigger than epsilon. Well, that's less than or equal to the probability that, well, twice the sup beta n bn bn L Pn beta minus L Pn beta is bigger than epsilon. And now using this inequality, we're simply less than or equal to, oh, here's where I get to know something about gamma. And so this is less than twice Bn plus 1 squared sigma Pn minus sigma Pn sup bigger than epsilon. Okay, so far so good. That's nice. No sweat. Markov. So if we Markov that, we get twice Bn plus 1 squared over epsilon expectation of empirical covariance matrix minus population covariance matrix, supernorm, coordinate-wise, supernorm of that matrix. Okay. That's really nice. That's good. So that's where Greenstein and Nemirovsky, or Greenstein and Ritov, use Nemirovsky's Inequality. So it's exactly at this stage that they bring in Nemirovsky. And so here I'm going to state Nemirovsky's lemma, or inequality, and then apply it to get their result. So this is Nemirovsky's Saint-Fleur lectures. I've forgotten the date, but it's Saint-Fleur. And he says in his lectures, his Saint-Fleur lectures, he's known this inequality for 20 years, but hasn't been able to find any other reference for it. So he was looking for other references, couldn't find one. I don't know another reference either. It was new to me. So I'm going to reuse X's. Pardon me for this, but these are different X's. These are independent. Expectations, zero, our usual setup. But they're in RD for D, three or more. So they're vectors in RD, mean zero. And, well, we're going to assume XI norm squared. Suppose that much, and maybe, well, the inequality only becomes meaningful if I have a finite there. So let me put an R there. Okay, so then this inequality says and the important part is actually that R can be infinite as well. So that's Nemirovsky's inequality. It's a very, very nice inequality. Nice thing is you have two things going on here, the R and the log of D, log of dimension. And when R is infinite, of course, it becomes just log of dimension. So the case or the version of this that Greenstein and Ritov use in handling this is exactly the R equals infinity case. So here what we do is we think about the difference in these matrices is just a long vector. So this is just sum 1 through n. Sum of vi's, where the vi's are independent and they depend upon n. So I'm going to write it as 1 over n to get the n from the empirical. And this is x0 minus its expectation, and so forth on through expectation under Pn. No, well, hang on. Pi minus its expectation under Pn. And so that thing is living in Pn plus 1 squared. So D now is P plus 1 squared, and that's where we're going to apply Nemirovsky. So Nemirovsky works just fine. And what does it say? Well, it says when I apply it here, this is less than or equal to an absolute constant times log of Pn plus 1 squared, 1 over n squared, sum from 1 through n, that gives me an n. Expectation of the maximum of these guys, well, I'm going to put in the envelope, which is exactly this infinity norm. And so I get over here, expectation of f of zi squared under Pn. So my hypothesis, the hypothesis of the theorem, is simply that this is bounded by an m. And what we're getting here is an absolute constant. When I put in Pn as n to the alpha, it becomes, well, upper bounded essentially by log alpha log n divided by n, right? So all that's involved in getting persistence is trading this off against the Bn here, and so that just works. So this is bounded by 2 Bn plus 1 squared over epsilon times twice an absolute constant. And now I need to use Jensen's inequality, so expectation of this to the first power is bounded by square root of this expectation by Jensen, and so I get to pull in square root of the bound here, which is alpha log of n over n. And when Bn is of the specified order, let's see, well, when Bn is little o, then it goes to zero, right? So that's the proof via Nemirovsky's inequality. See, what do we think of if we're doing empirical process theory? Well, I've got a finite list of functions here, finite list, d long, d is p plus 1 squared. In empirical process theory, we have things called bracketing bounds. And I can think about bracketing. And bracketing bounds are something that I've developed in connection with central limit theorems for empirical processes. So second proof of an inequality here that works just fine is via bracketing. So my proof is simply trivial observation here. We simply have a class of functions, which are fjk of z. Well, these guys are between 0 and pn. So I've got a list of functions, pn plus 1 squared long. And I can find brackets very easily. So a lower bracket I can take just to be fjkz minus epsilon over 2. And an upper bracket of z to be fjk of z plus epsilon over 2. And this gives me size epsilon brackets with respect to almost any norm I want. So the empirical process bounds are usually stated in terms of empirical measure minus truth times square root of n. And those bounds say expectation of gn souped over the class of functions. Well, here the class of functions is just finite. It's a finite list. So this is less than or equal to up to constants, the bracketing entropy integral. So you take this thing at 1 to the class f under L2Pn, and then times the envelope for the class under Pn and 2. Well, what is that stuff? It's integral up to a constant square root of log of the minimal number of epsilon brackets needed to cover the class. And so you can see, what is that in this case? It's pretty trivial. I certainly can cover the class with just that many brackets, pn plus 1 squared. It's very easy. So in this case, this is just bounded by log of pn plus 1 squared times, well, the L2p norm, so expectation under pn of my envelope squared z square root. Well, that's all bounded by log pn plus 1 squared up to a constant, and then the constant m coming from our hypothesis. So if I divide back through by the square root of n that's sitting in here, I get a bound that's just the same as Nemirovsky. So it's just the same coming from the bracketing entropy bound. And so I have a bound of exactly the same order coming from bracketing, and so the proof just goes the same way. So I can replace bracketing entropy bounds. I can replace Nemirovsky by bracketing entropy, and I get just the same result. So I have no improvement, no big gain. I just have a different proof. And it's a pretty trivial use of bracketing. But if you think about things here a little bit, so the proof of this bracketing bound is complicated. That involves a very complicated truncation argument, trading off. Even with a finite number, it takes trading off at least three terms, a truncation term, an L1 term coming from Bernstein, and an L2 term coming from Bernstein. You've got to trade off at least those three, and I'm not sure you can do it even then, even with just a crude, easy, finite number. So in any case, Nemirovsky looks pretty good. It's a pretty good bound. It's very interesting, and its proof is completely different than the proof of this bracketing entropy bound. It's just totally different. So I'd like to just sketch the proof of Nemirovsky to the degree I understand it, and see if anybody else knows some of the pieces I don't know, and stop there. So here's Nemirovsky's inequality, what I understand of it so far. So Nemirovsky starts by analyzing a function v of x that maps Rd into R1, which is just the norm squared, say, in the Rth norm. Rth norm squared. So he claims this is uniformly differentiable for R bigger than 2, and it satisfies the following inequality. So those first two terms are simply, if you take a linear approximation to V in the direction Y, and so if you took a difference here, wrote a minus sign, and just use differentiability, this should be little o of y. So difference of this side and that side should be little o of y. And moreover, Nemirovsky claims, and this is the neat trick in his proof that I don't fully understand yet. That you can put over there an absolute constant c times this number times v back. Now, in some sense, that smells right because you ought to have a quadratic term here. This is a linear term. This is a quadratic term. Oh, there's a square there. That's good. That's smelling right. But this inequality is the heart of his proof. And so C is absolute. And if I understand things, C is 8 or maybe 16. I'm not quite sure. It's one of those two. It's not too big. It's a reasonable constant. So in applying this, well, it's easy. You take x to be the sum from 1 through n of xi. You take y to be xn plus 1. And so then we get v of the sum from 1 through n plus 1 of xi less than or equal to v sum 1 through n of xi plus xn plus 1 transpose times the gradient of v evaluated at sum of the first n plus constant times r times v of xn plus 1. And then you take expectations, and a very nice thing happens because these have mean 0 and they're independent. So independence of this and that with mean 0 means when you take expectations, this term drops out. It's gone. So expectation of v of the sum of the xi's is less than or equal to expectation v sum of the xi's first n plus constant r expectation v of xn plus 1. And of course, now what one does is to recurse that relationship, just recursion, do it again on this term. And so one is less than or equal to, at the end of the day, after recursion, C times R times the sum from 1 through n plus 1 of expectation V of xi. Okay, so that's his inequality with the constant being the original constant from his differential inequality times R. There's no dimension appearing yet. Now he gets the dimension in there in the log form as follows. He says, well, for choose an R prime, another value for the norm. Then we get XR norm is smaller than the XR prime norm, and that's less than or equal to D to the 1 over R prime minus 1 over R XR norm. Oh, that's very nice because it relates things two ways. We've got control on this guy above by that, and then this is controlled in terms above by a multiple on this side. That's very nice. And so we're going to take R prime to be twice the log. Let's see if I got this right. Yeah, R prime is twice the log of D. Okay. R prime is twice the log of D. So, this is VR, and this is exactly what we're interested in is inequality. If we use the first inequality on the left, we get simply expectation of the same thing with an R prime. And then we apply this result, or the previous part with the R, and we get less than or equal to constant times twice the log of D. Well, that's what R prime is, right? There's the R prime coming in. Expectation sum 1 through N. Xi r prime squared, oops, no, sum should be outside now, because I'm applying his inequality, and now we can play that bound, the upper bound, and so we get constant times twice the log of D, sum 1 through N, expectation of D to the 1 over R prime minus 1 over R, norm X I R squared. And do we need a 2 here? Squared there, I guess. Okay, so anyway, that does it. Here's the log of D. And what you've got sitting here, D to the 2 over R prime, when you think about it, that's a complicated way of writing E. So this is 2 E C log D times what we want. So the bound holds with some constant and either R or log of D. And the constant you get is 2EC, where C is the inequality from up there. And so that means this is either 2 times 8 times E, or 2 times 16 times E. And it works. Now, one thing nice about that for me is that they're very explicit constants if I get this right, once I get the right constant up there. And if any of you have seen an inequality like that before and know how to prove this in an elementary way, that'd be great. I'd be very interested. In his Sonfleur lectures, Nemirovsky refers to his book in 1983 with Yudin, which is a very nice book on all kinds of computational aspects, algorithmic things. And this inequality is a part of a bigger theory of regular spaces. And so he has regular spaces and inequalities for them, and more or less to be analyzing the behavior of algorithms rather than statistical context. So this inequality is part of a bigger theory, and I have the feeling that for Nemirovsky this is a trivial case because it's finite dimensional, and he knows easily what goes there from all his general theory. So he has quite a theory in that book of regular spaces and bounds and things like this for optimization purposes. In any case, this gives a totally different proof of something that seems to be the same degree of sharpness as our bracketing entropy bounds from empirical process theory. And it could very easily be that if we use this as a starting point in chaining arguments, we'll actually get better bounds for bracketing in our empirical process theory with sharper constants. Okay. So I haven't talked a whole lot about the high-dimensional stuff. I've just given one proof of one result of Greenstein and Ritthoff. It's the easy case. Indeed, many of you at this conference are doing much harder things, much more delicate things. This is just one easy proof that was sort of early in the theory, but I still find quite interesting. And I learned a lot just trying to understand it and understand the inequalities. So thanks very much.
Are there any questions, comments, or answers, really?
I think that it is easy because you have beta and beta star, beta hat and beta star in L1 bodies.
Yes.
And you can, if you look at this proof, you can carry it out also for non-stochastic regressors. It will be even simpler because you don't have this products xi xj, they will disappear, only products xi y.
Mm-hmm. So for the L1 case?
Yes, if you take the penalized class, then you have no right to stay in the L1 body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole
R. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, there are a number of interesting directions and avenues to pursue here, closely related things. This is just one theorem and a whole cast of things. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to ask you, the procedure is a lasso, but with a lambda which depends on the underlying distribution, right?
Yeah, the target here is left, very vague, and well, but it's one of the attractions of their definition, I think, that they do not assume a truth. They just say,
well, except that if among those PMs there are Ys which are of the form beta x transpose plus epsilon, and then that is,
then you're getting business, yeah, sure. But it's still more general than that. Yeah.
Question: is there anything in Nemirovsky's theory which deals with the range 1 R between 1 and 2?
Probably is. He seems to be able to cover everything. I'm not sure about getting an absolute constant in that case. Certainly in his soft floor lectures, he has it explicitly stated for R is bigger than or equal to 2.
I think that might have some implications for cross-validation.
Yeah. Seems like a very useful inequality. Nice one to add to the bag of tricks. It was new to me. It's not to say it's could be known in some groups, but it certainly was new to me and all the empirical process stuff I've looked at. And seems very, very nice and a totally different proof than bracketing type bound.
Any further comments or questions? No.